You're listening to Soldanela, Four Notes from a Native Daughter. My guest is the amazing Frances Negron Muntaner, a Puerto Rican award-winning filmmaker, writer, curator, scholar, and professor at Columbia University. Today is Father's Day, and we kick off with a little story about her father and how that really fundamentally changes the course of her life. And then we delve into the learning and takeaways of the amazing and timely project, Valor y Cambio.
So first of all, Frances, thank you so much for your time. I'm so excited.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
You started off researching because of your dad. This is going to be published today on, you know, Father's Day. So I figured that would be like a nice way to like segue into started like working for him, like he put you to work in this research project, and what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, I remember very clearly these moments when I started becoming a researcher, and I remember very distinctly the moments that led me to become a visual artist. They both involve family members. So in the case of my father, the very first vivid memory I have of him introducing me to the world of research was when he was a grad student at Stony Brook University in the 70s. And of course, it's before computers, and, you know, my parents are, right, you know, students without much income, you know. And what he would do is he would ask me if I would sit down with him to copy edit his manuscript.
Oh, wow.
So I was about 8 or 9, and I would sit next to him and I would read aloud his dissertation so he could make corrections in his copy. And his dissertation was about the political orientation of the autonomista elite in Puerto Rico during the 19th century. So he was investigating and trying to understand why was it that the Puerto Rican elite during that period was oriented towards an autonomy project from Spain rather than a pro-independence project. So that was, I think, my first introduction to historical research, basically proofreading my dad's dissertation.
But this is kind of endearing. So you're 8 or 9, like, reading a dissertation. So this actually then had to have had an impact in the way you read.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it had all kinds of impacts. I mean, as you know, dissertations are quite long, you know, so we're talking about hundreds of pages, right? So you acquire a certain discipline and a certain disposition. I guess some kids might have ended up hating it, you know, that could have been a response as well. But in my case, I ended up loving it. Just to sit, and also it was time with your dad. So so it was so many things. On the one hand, it was your introduction to the world research, your introduction to Puerto Rican history. That doesn't start, let's say, in your immediate moment or shortly before. It begins, you know, a century ago. It's also skills of grammar and sentence structure and how do you tell a story. And on top of all that, it's also hours sitting with your dad, you know, on a common goal, right? Or supporting him, in my case, towards a goal. And, you know, so that's very foundational, all those elements. When I look back on everything I've done, particularly in the last about 20 years, I would say that historical foundation has come back as something very fundamental for me. And I think the story you probably read had to do with when we returned to Puerto Rico. Once my father had his PhD, my mother also had an MA degree that she did while he was doing his PhD. We returned to Puerto Rico. And during the summers, my father started researching urban slavery in Puerto Rico. So as you can tell, he's a 19th century historian. And for that project, I was already a bit older. So I was in my teens, early teens. And he would take me to the Archivo Nacional on a regular basis, mostly in the summers when there was no school, but all the time. So he went different tasks for me. So I remember vividly, he gave me these registers that were enslaved people's registries, right? And he told me to go through them and annotate characteristics of the people that were listed. And that was my first, I think, profound reckoning with the fact that Puerto Rico, not that long before my own time, had enslaved people, and what the impact of that is to not only then, but still to this day, or to the moment that I was reading. And I never forget that some of the details that were listed in those registers had to do with signs of physical abuse. So it would be noted as a distinctive characteristic that someone was missing an ear or a hand. You know, so in that sense, I would say that second project was foundational as well, because it made me aware in ways that I didn't have access to in school or in other or in the media or in other spaces about the fact of enslavement, its legacy and impact in Puerto Rican society. What stayed with me from that was that that our country was founded to a large extent on this experience of enslavement, and that it still was structuring society in certain ways. And I think those realizations are part of the work that I did later as an adult. So that's why I would say that was another foundational moment for me, an awareness of race, awareness of racial inequity and hierarchy, an awareness of the privilege of lighter skinned people, white people in Puerto Rico, and also how that plays out between Puerto Rico and the United States in terms of colonialism. Since both my parents were university professors, and I went to the University High School, for instance, which is attached to the University of Puerto Rico or part of it, I had this awareness of the university as an institution, its effects, its history. And I always felt ambivalent about it. On the one hand, it was so formative for me. I think it's hard for me to imagine my trajectory without me having those experiences in those institutions. It was also the space of work for my parents, and that made it a very everyday aspect of our lives. You know, we were talking at home about the university, about debates, intellectual debates, and so forth. On the other hand, if you grew up in Puerto Rico during that period, you know that there was a strike very frequently. It could be a student strike, a faculty strike, or an employee strike. And the fact that you were on the clock of the University of Puerto Rico from high school, basically since you were 12, and in your house earlier on, because my parents were working there, made you very aware also of the limitations and the complexity of that institution. So when I migrate to the U.S., I there's another layer to that understanding, and the layer has to do with the ways that, and the realization, also looking back, of the ways that universities are organized also along the lines of coloniality. So these are institutions that presumably are producing knowledge and so forth, but they're also, more than anything, reproducing social inequities at many levels, the very epistemology, the very frameworks that we are using. So in that sense, and when I start being introduced to Latino studies, ethnic studies, African-American studies, it becomes very clear to me early on in this migratory process that if what you're studying is power, and if what you're studying or trying to understand or grapple with are inequities and hierarchies, it makes pretty much no sense that everything that you're writing is for other academics, which in many ways are privileged people, which doesn't mean that they are not touched, of course, or shaped or have to contend with these same structures. But it seems that this knowledge that has value and to everyone and should be shared widely. Like the title of that documentary on ethnic studies called Precious Knowledge. In my trajectory, one of the goals, particularly when I entered the Ivy League, was that it didn't make any sense for me to be producing for a discipline or for advancement in the sense of a career. The main goal of my production had to be to transform, to share with other people, to think together, to not only bring quote-unquote knowledge from academia out, but also bring knowledge from outside academia in. So for instance, one of the things that was so incredible for me about Valor y Cambio was that it started in some ways of me trying to share what I had learned after 2 years in a working group about debt crisis and community currencies and other ways to think about what we call the economy. But at the end, you know, the project and my own trajectory was transformed by what I learned from people and from the experience of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the main concept that has arisen from the project so far, which I call decolonial joy, emerged as a way of me trying to understand people's response to the project and talking to them about it. I don't think I would have produced or arrived at such concept or thought along those lines, which in tandem also changed the way I thought more generally, if I hadn't entered that exchange.
So now let's go to Valor y Cambio. And in the interest of the people that might not know about Valor y Cambio, can you briefly describe what it is?
Yes. So one way to describe it is that it's a public art installation that combines principles of just economy and community currencies and storytelling to achieve three goals, basically. The first goal was to provide a platform for people to ask themselves and reflect on the question of value. What do you value? What is valuable? The second goal was to introduce the idea of community currency, which was a practice that before I was part of the working group, I had very little information about, didn't really had heard much about it, but I mm-hmm. thought it was an important concept to introduce to Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And the third goal that the project has is to provide a platform or an experience so people can partake into an experience of a solidarity economy that's not organized around profit or accumulation.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end, what the project created, and I wasn't even that clear about this when we began, but it became very clear the first day that we put the ATM machine down to the on the floor mm-hmm. and people started going to it, was that what we had actually done was we created a storytelling economy where the unit of value was the exchange of narratives. So the way the whole experience was organized is that in exchange of what you told us about what you value and the stories that you shared, you received a currency, one to 25, six denominations at random. And in the back of that currency, there was a QR code where you could take your phone and go to the QR code, which then it would take you to the website and tell you a story about the person or persons or community that was featured on that bill. So the first experience is the participants give the project a story, the project gives the participant a story through the bills.
Mm-hmm.
Then at the beginning, I wasn't even sure this was gonna happen, but eventually we ended up with 42 businesses that were willing to accept that currency during the time we were in the project was going in Puerto Rico. And the exchange we made with them, if they accepted the currency, we would promote their story on social media. So every participant in this project would obtain something they found valuable by sharing stories or accepting stories, right?
So it's like we learn from one another at a very basic level.
Yeah, and also we created a currency that was paper, which is mm-hmm. almost obsolete in many places in the world. And we were aware that the future of mainstream currency is digital. But we created something on paper because we had the hypothesis that if people had paper, they would talk to each other and interact with each other more. And that was very valuable for our project. Because as a participatory exchange project, if that kind of situation didn't happen, we would be missing out on a lot. And in fact, that was what happened. Except there was a twist. So people stood in line, you know, for hours to get their story and their bill to tell their story, and that happened every day for days. But then, most people, the vast majority of people, did not exchange their bills at all. Once they obtained them, they kept them.
Mm-hmm. Because they were beautiful.
Well, that's what decolonial joy comes from as a concept. I started asking people, why are you not spending the bills? And because our thought was, okay, so we are introducing a community currency, people sometimes would do this repeatedly. So it means that by the end of a couple of days, they might have had over $100 in their hand. So, and they could exchange it in 42 locations for everything from tea to books, food. A lot of the participating businesses were food. So you think, you know, if this is a country that's in a very steep economic crisis, and where poverty rates have risen tremendously as a result of the austerity, Maria, and other factors, why is it that people are not spending it? And when I started talking to people, I heard a lot of reasons. Some people said they were beautiful, and that was very interesting, because what it said is that many Puerto Ricans value art.
Mm-hmm.
So much that they prefer to keep $25 at home than spend them if they're beautiful. Other reasons, though, is more where I think the colonial joy comes. It's like a lot of people had an emotional response to receiving the bills. They cried, or mm-hmm. they sometimes cried because they were moved by my memory or something, or they cried because they were so excited to get the bill out of happiness. And that's where the reason that people would tell me is that the bills represented another possible world.
Mm-hmm.
And the specific coordinates of what that world was depended on people. Some people thought that or identified because of a bill that had women or had Puerto Ricans who are Black, or labor leaders, or doctors, or writers. Or it was the 25 bill, which was the community of El Caño Martín Peña, represented by three young people selected by El Caño to provide the face of the community and the story. I think that so that joy that I witnessed again and again and again was a joy that was political. And I mean political not in the narrow sense of political parties or anything like that. I mean mm-hmm. political in the sense of how power is exercised and who exercises that power and to what end and for what and for whom. So yeah, so that's I think a lot of the twist, which is that instead of using it to the ostensible, you know, reason that you would use currency, it meant so much more to people that they did not want to part with it.
And when we spoke last week, you mentioned that the project, you know, changed your life, and it has to do with the power of storytelling and this storytelling economy. And when people are asked, what do you value? Talk about that process and that all of those comments that really moved you.
Well, I think this project changed my life at a lot of different levels. At one level, I had never done a visual project of this kind. I have made a number of films before, and I had always related to film as a political practice. Like my first film, for instance, was about the socioeconomic, cultural context of the AIDS epidemic for Puerto Ricans. So I always saw filmmaking as a political practice to engage in dialogue. But I had never done something like Valor y Cambio. And to tell you a story that represents why that seemed very different from making a film, mm-hmm. is that the first day when we tested the project, we went to the testing site, which was a restaurant in Old San Juan called De La Verdura, and we put the poster up of the project. And the poster, one of the most important things that it said was, se aceptan pesos. Pesos are accepted here, which is the name of the currency. And then under it, it had where it was accepted and for how long and so forth. So we put up the poster, and immediately I saw how that object, which opened up an entire possibility of being and a possible different future and different relations between people and different priorities, affected that space. So people would walk by and said, what do you mean, pesos? What is that? Immediately, it started conversation, and it started shifting people's minds about the possible. And whereas a film can do that for sure, people tend to see films either in a dark theater where you can't talk, you know, or you mm-hmm. see it in your computer individually or in a family setting, but in a so-called private. Whereas this was happening in real time, this exchange of knowledge, of perspectives, and shifts in how we're relating to each other was unfolding before your eyes. So that was one dimension of the project that I changed my practice forever. The other thing that that was transformative was joy itself. I think, and when we brought the project to New York, I think this was very dramatic, because in New York we had joy in the project, but we also had many other challenges that we didn't have in Puerto Rico, and one of them was the way people responded to the project was quite different. So experiencing this project in Puerto Rico for 8 days with young people, older people, people from all walks of life, from all backgrounds, and being able to share this and co-produce this joyful experience really changed me in the sense that you realize that perhaps there's not enough joy in what you're doing or where you live or how you're relating to other people and how fundamental that is. You know, after feeling such joy in working on something, in sharing it, in thinking together about possibilities, I was just not the same person.
Mm-hmm. And what do people value? And what is the difference between what kids value, women value, and men value?
Well, we are at this very moment transcribing the testimonies and stories from the New York part of the project, the New York trajectory. Mm-hmm. We already transcribed everything from Puerto Rico, where over 1,000 recordings. So our next part of that process is to bring them together to compare and to start mapping out what people said. But I heard a lot on site, and I also read hundreds of the Puerto Rico transcriptions. And there was something that really caught my eye or ear, you know, from mm-hmm. from what I've seen. And it was that when the project asked you, what do you value? Most people, the overwhelming majority of people, did not say things that were perhaps to other people might seem obvious. Practically nobody said job, money, the economy. And again, we had to remember, we are in an austerity situation where all those things are lacking and are affecting people's lives in very specific ways.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's saying that. People, after they say family, which most people say family first, the second thing and third things people bring up is education, health, community, solidarity. And that was very revealing and very important politically, because precisely those are the areas undermined by the current policies of austerity. And those are precisely the areas that the government is not taking care of and that people find it very important. So there's obviously a very big gap between what people are articulating as what they want politics to be about and how they want resources to be spent, which is the opposite of what pretty much the government is doing, both governments. And that was a very important thing. So when people, what do people value? Well, people value a joyful life.
Yeah.
You know, that, and they know that joy doesn't come necessarily from, not that it's unimportant, but it doesn't come from money.
Yeah.
They know it comes from family, communal ties. They come from the possibilities that people may have to act and develop their capacities. And I think that's why education came out so much. Because people sometimes elaborated what they meant by education, and it wasn't education as a means to upward mobility. It was mm-hmm. education in relation to valuing and taking care of the environment of other people. You know, so it wasn't an instrumental vision of education. And in terms of differences I mean, we're going to get much more specific about differences between men and women, and maybe younger people, older people. I think in New York was where I saw children, 9 to 11, because in New York, we actually worked with groups of kids that visited the project. So we were able to have more in-depth conversations with kids. And there, one of the most revealing things for me was how aware kids that age are about economic relations, their hierarchies, how aware they are about their own, how they fit or don't fit into the economy. For instance, I noticed from Puerto Rico, and that was also happened in New York, that kids love the project. So in New York, because I had time, I could ask, why do you love the project? And there was a boy about 9 who was, you know, incredibly articulate in his response. He said, we love the project because children don't get money. And this project allows us to contribute, receive something that then we can decide how to spend. I thought, wow. So basically what he was saying is that the project recognized and included children as being able to contribute to a collective economy.
Well, their value, precisely.
Exactly, their value, which brings me to when we went to one of the schools, we went to several schools in Puerto Rico. So we're talking now about high schoolers. And there was an interview that we did with a young woman about 16 in Macau. And she said, what I love about this project is that I feel that I'm being heard and that the project values me and what I have to contribute and what I have to say. And that's not something that happens in relation to young people in this country.
Right. Yeah.
So that's another dimension. I think so for the younger kids that I mentioned, the young kid that I mentioned, for him it was a recognition of his agency as a part of the community, in the sense of being able to make decisions and contribute. In the case of the young woman in Macau, it was about recognition of their value also, but at this other level, right? So you're right. It was basically kids saying this project recognizes us, values us, and sees us as an integral part of the community.
Yeah. And so as you have evolved with this, now you come to Just Exchanges. How do you arrive there?
Well, one of the things that happened pretty much immediately that the project began to run is that some communities articulated an interest in developing actual community currencies, because the community currency that we developed was an art currency that was only useful, if you will, during the time of the project. Although, of course, people found many other uses for it because they didn't use it, you know, as for exchange purposes, right? But it was not meant, this currency that we created, it was not meant to be actually used by a community for a long period of time. It just only meant for the experience that the project provided. The first community to come forward that said, we want to develop a community currency was El Caño Martín Peña. And that made sense because they were the community that was closest to us in many ways, because we wanted to tell their story as part of the project. And that brought me to go to El Caño and ask permission, can we tell your story as part of our project? And the minute that they heard what the project was about, they invited us to bring the project to their market that gathers on Sunday, and then, you know, they involved the young people with the project. After the market, also visited the youth leadership program in El Caño. So there was a deepening relationship between Valor y Cambio and El Caño. And in that process, they said, we have a use for a community currency here in El Caño, and we'd like to work with you on that. So after the project wrapped, the tour part of the project in Puerto Rico, I flew back and we had a workshop. And in that workshop, which is interesting because it included people, also young people, older people, all kinds of people, which is, I think, also a testament to how El Caño is run politically, like who participates. And in that day-long workshop, the participants identified what the currency was, how it was going to be called, what kind of stories it would circulate, where was it going to be used, and so forth. Months later, you know, so by the end of the year, pretty much, El Caño Martín Peña had the first, let's say, contemporary community currency in the history of Puerto Rico that's functioning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, around, you know, March or April, after the February run in Puerto Rico, I got an invitation from Libertad Guerra and Yasmin Ramirez to be part of an exhibit in New York, and that's what brings the project to New York.
Mm-hmm.
We were in various locations throughout East Harlem, and in that process, there was starting to emerge the idea of creating a community currency for New York. Eventually, there's a group that becomes constituted that comes up with the Just Exchanges rubric and has been meeting regularly to bring this idea to fruition. And lately, what we've been doing is circulating some survey materials, both on the question of solidarity economies. How would people interact with them? Do they feel they are needed? How would they contribute? What would they need from the solidarity economy? So we did a series of surveys on that. And now we've been gathering thoughts about what to call the community currency. And that's been another round of surveys. Actually, the currency part of the project was what took the longest. So we devoted about 8 months to developing the currency, what stories it would tell, what figures it would have. Mm-hmm. And in that part of the process, we studied currencies from everywhere in the world, particularly islands. Mm-hmm. We also studied many community currencies, both circulating today and historic ones. And we also looked at art currencies or the ways that artists have imagined alternative currencies. So there was a pretty long process in that first phase. And as we continued, we met more and more people working in community currencies in other parts of the world. In fact, for Just Exchanges, we had a period of time where we had conversations with people that have been involved or are involved in community currency projects in various parts of the world. And of course, the role of art is essential in this process. In fact, one of the things that I learned by studying community currencies is that they often emerge from artists.
Right.
It's often artists that start community currency projects in various parts of the world. So although we were not aware of that history when we started doing this, it became, you know, we can recognize that our story was similar to that story. And one of the questions that one might ask is why? Why is art so important to the imagining of alternative currencies? And some of the reasons have to do with that a lot of artists engage in exchange economies to do their art. And if you think about it, the concept of money is a concept of the imagination, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And in times of crisis, including debt and austerity crisis, another part of the work that we did studying debt crisis, we also saw that artists played a role in imagining alternatives to what was going on. So in that sense, you cannot really separate art from the project, our project, and many other community currency projects. So it doesn't surprise me that artists, for instance, would be at the forefront of interpolating others to the importance of what kinds of stories bills tell.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of, in fact, one of the things that I often do when I give talks about the project is that I provide a comparison between the dollar, the one, the five, the 10, the 20, compared to our one, our two, our five, our 10, our 21. And immediately people see the difference. And now we're talking about what does the currency represent?
Yeah.
What values, what stories do they tell?
Mm-hmm.
And the difference is enormous. In fact, one of the kids that we talked to in New York, when I said, well, what's the difference between this currency that you have now and the dollar? What's on them? And they were completely aware that the dollar just had white men that are rich. It's like what the kid said. Well, it has white men that are rich. So what does that say about what the U.S. values? Yeah. Or what stories and what subjects, what people, and how do they understand power and value? Because it's in the U.S. currency, value and power seem to be conflated into the state power. Whereas in our currency, you have athletes and you have educators and doctors and communities and activists and labor organizers and feminists and poets.
That's fascinating. And what do you want to make of all of this? What are you going to do with all those stories and all those?
Well, we're going to, we're transcribing the everything because we are going to issue a report.
Okay.
And in the report, we're going to detail what people said and do more of the analysis that you requested earlier. Was there any correlation between gender or race or location where people live or education or other factors in what people said that they valued? Mm-hmm. And we also want to compare Puerto Rico to New York.
Yeah.
Because people in New York said very different things than in Puerto Rico. Another is that the machine also asked participants two other questions, and those are no less revealing. The second question was, what does your community already do to support what you value? Or what are the obstacles, for the community to support what you value? And there were patterns there as well. I mean, the vast majority of people spoke about precisely the state and government as obstacles. There was another, the third question, which was, what organizations or what people already do what you value? And that was very interesting because the vast majority of participants could not name any one or any organization.
Mm.
And I think that was politically important because that suggested that although people knew what they valued, they weren't connected to other people that valued similar things. In New York, a lot of people expressed strong feelings about gentrification.
Yeah.
And that wasn't something that emerged. And with the children, it was impactful that so many of them said the same things that what they were concerned about. And the two things that they most mentioned was they were concerned that they were going to die in a school shootout in the school.
Mm.
And they were concerned that when they grew up, there would be no planet for them.
Aww.
And these are, 9, 10, 11-year-olds. They're already very aware of some of the challenges that, everybody's facing at this moment. And they're already concerned about the impact, short-term and long-impact of these challenges to them. So we're going to issue the report. And I think that's going to be an interesting document in all those ways. And I hope that it's used by people. It's also a way to return the stories to our participants and to share them with others. And we're also making a film about the process of the project, both in Puerto Rico and New York. And one of the things that's interesting about the film is that whereas I would say on the ground, the dominant feeling was joy in Puerto Rico, and joy and stress, I think, in New York. Mm-hmm. The film feels a bit like a comedy. You know, it has a lot of humor as we encounter multiple obstacles along the way of making this project a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And in our interactions with people, like what we learn from each other was often humorous.
That's kind of lovely, right?
I think so. I mean, there's not very many political films that are humorous.
Yeah.
incorporate humor as a way of knowing, a way of telling the story.
Yeah. Oh, it's like the great Puerto Rican saying. Actually, I don't know if it's from Puerto Rico, but se sufre pero se goza.
Well, we go back to joy, right?
Yeah,
we go back to joy and its fundamental importance in human life,
yeah.
and the reason we are alive,
right? The reason we are alive, and then also what the little prince says, what's important is what you don't necessarily see with your eyes, but you feel in your heart.
Yeah, and I think that was evident in the emotion. Like, for instance, when people cried, which was somewhat common or frequent, I sometimes would ask people. And some of the things people said, I mean, they ran the gamut. Like a young man that said, I learned something, and this was tears of sadness. Like he said, I learned that I'm not a good person. And then I said, why you say that? And he said, because I see that I don't do anything for anyone. And when I see you here, and he also identified people that were in our group that were not Puerto Ricans, and I see people that are not even Puerto Ricans trying to do something for Puerto Rico, and I have to think about what am I doing, right? To a woman that I remember started to cry when she got the bill, and I said, why? And she said, I did this for my son, who is in Texas, and he would have wanted to be here, but he migrated. And I think the emotion there was that he wasn't there. So, which in the Decolonial Joy essay, I go into the paradox of joy, which joy is often the most intense when we have suffered. So yes. If I pinpoint the suffering that I saw was informing this joy at times, it was austerity, it was Hurricane Maria, and it was migration, the absence of loved ones in, that are no longer part of the community in a day-to-day sense.
Yeah, that's profound.
But I mean, going forward, for the project, you know, we have these follow-up projects. The project is also part of an exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Puerto Rico. So we hope that when the museum opens, we'll be able to participate. But on the other side of transforming the economy, I think the Pasos del Caño Martín Peña, their currency project, other currency projects that we are now in dialogue with schools in Puerto Rico, and also the Just Exchanges in New York, are all efforts to do something that's fundamental and necessary, which is we need to redefine what we mean by the economy, and we have to place well-being, community well-being, at the center of economic, so-called economic activity. And that's, you know, a lot of a lot of the energies that we are with our group is investing now is in that goal.
I love it. I'm super proud of you.
Oh,
thank you for all of this. Yeah, no, you are one in a million, Frances Negrón Montaner. This is, I think your project is one of the most valuable ones. I think, you know, for especially, you know, for this generation and for what we're living through right now. Not only, you know, not only Puerto Rico, but the globe. How are we going to transform? What are the things that society can do to change? But it is possible, right? It is possible to have a different end.
Well, I think so. I think studying Puerto Rico for decades in one way or another, one of the things that is evident to me is that I found very receptive people in Puerto Rico for radical transformation in ways that I didn't so much find it in the United States. The thing about Puerto Rico is that in some ways, Puerto Ricans are a little ahead in the ways that that this system oppresses people, you know, because it's at multiple levels, and not coincidentally, it that experience also makes many Puerto Ricans have developed a certain knowledge about what needs to be done. So in that sense, I think Puerto Rico is a place from where transformative practice is happening, and I personally think that transformative things will come out of there to share with the world.
We'll conclude here. I want to read this report, and I definitely want to. I'm looking forward to that, and then letting, you know, the world know about it.
Well, for sure. It should be in the next few months. It will be out there.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for
thank
what
you.
You've done.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Dale. Un abrazo.
Un abrazo. Bye-bye.